Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Man, Jake, there's a lot going on in AEW right now. It's kind of overwhelming. I'm sitting here trying to figure out what to start with, and it's like Okada and Ishii and Danielson and Blackpool Combat. It's like mystery partner this and challenge that, and there's Rampage with MJF for the first time, and Collision with a tournament for Owen Hart, and all this stuff going on, and of course Forbidden Door. I'm kind of overwhelmed. That's a lot. I'm sorry to lead with that because I'm sure everybody's got their favorite part of tonight's show because there was so much going on. But that was a lot, Jake.
Yeah, there's a lot of tournaments happening, you know, and it's one of the things that really got away from AEW last year, and I think has really corresponded with a downturn in their business overall in terms of attendance and television ratings and things of that nature was when so much was happening simultaneously, whether it was the launch of ROH or the Forbidden Door sort of damaging the booking of last summer. And I guess you could throw injuries into that pile as well as being a part of it. But I think from a booking perspective, it was always just the pacing issues that all these things introduce. And I think that was really on display tonight, where it was just like the double-barreled shotgun blast of information and content and trying to get it all into 2 hours. It's difficult to catch all of it while you're watching, and then it's just like another level of difficulty if you're actually trying to jot down things that are happening on the show.
Yeah, Jason Paul on the flagship yesterday, the Wade Keller Wrestling Podcast flagship, our Blue Logo Show. Search Wade Keller if you haven't heard it yet, and subscribe to our Blue Logo Show. This is our Red Logo Show, the Poe Show. No, I don't have to say that later. Jason mentioned Excalibur doesn't need to say every match on every show that's coming up between this Dynamite and next week's Dynamite. There's the old thing that I heard Kevin Dunn and Vince McMahon thought about how to promote things on their TV shows. And it was the rule of 2.5, and where you just want, generally at the end of a TV show, there should be 2.5 things that fans or viewers are thinking about, two major items and then something else that people might have in the back of their mind. This is like, I don't know, 25.5 things. It just was a lot. And I mean, it's exciting. It's a super great weekend of all kinds of gathering of stars from New Japan, and AEW. And you've got, CM Punk is back. You've got the Owen Hart tournament starting. You've got this tag team tournament where Adam Cole and MJF have been aligned via random draw. For AEW fans, this is just an awesome weekend. And especially if you're a New Japan fan also, that's a big part, or a Punk fan. But I do worry, like you say, about declining attendance and ratings that go beyond just cord cutting in terms of the stats, if there isn't a bit of being overwhelmed. And, this happened last year too. There's a crowd singing along to theme songs and popping for wrestlers and key moves. And you've got, I think a self-awareness with Excalibur saying, Okada's Rainmaker has made him a legend, and kind of explaining it's a ripcord clothesline. There's a little bit of explaining going on, giving a little bit of background on some of the New Japan stars. But if you are tuning in, I think the casual AEW viewer, or even a hardcore AEW fan who just isn't super familiar with New Japan, comes away thinking, this is a big deal. This is special. And I think a lot of people, based on the buy rate last year, were like, I want to see what this is all about. But in terms of having a really clear idea of what the issues are and why these are dream singles matches or tag matches, it was a lot packed into 2 hours, and it was a lot packed into the last few weeks. And I'm not sure, it's so hard to do this. You're introducing a bunch of wrestlers who a big part of your fan base knows and loves, and booking matches that your core fan base are just, it's baked in that they're going to love this. So you don't want to you know, spend too much time holding the hands of people who don't get it. Just tell them, just watch, you'll love it too. But is there a happy medium in terms of how to do this? I mean, how do you think they're doing as far as this goes? Should they be saving all the New Japan wrestlers just for Forbidden Door? Does it water down some of the novelty to have them doing run-ins and getting beat up? Or is that a positive? Because you are showing you're helping sell tickets every year around this time for people who just want to see, who can't be in Toronto or wherever Forbidden Door is, who want to be able to see some of these New Japan stars in person. So, you know, it could in that sense help ticket sales and maybe ratings a little bit in that way. But do you think this is the right way to go about it, throwing that much out there in 2 hours like this?
I mean, I guess I would prefer if they spread it out a little bit further back in time. You know, I think it's difficult because Tony Khan has made comments on numerous occasions about how, you know, this is definitely a strategy for him. You know, he thinks that they get a lot of benefit from packing episodes very close to pay-per-views. And I think he's defended that in the past. So I don't think this is happening by accident. I think there is a bit of a plan at work, and it's just not one that jives with my personal tastes. And so I guess if it were me and my company, I certainly would try to spread this out over 3 or 4 weeks of television and allow for more interviews, allow for more video, allow for more announcer explanations, so that you're really setting the stage for some of these matches. Because while Danielson and Okada and Omega and Ospreay are, you know, two main events anywhere in the world, I don't think they gave you, other than some video packages, a lot of, reason to tune in. I mean, we did get the attacks and whatnot, but I wanted to hear more from Ospreay. I wanted to hear more from Omega. I was hoping to hear from Danielson when they advertised him calling out Okada, and it was just sort of a couple of minute thing without a whole lot of words said. And so I guess I would appreciate more from a story perspective than what we're getting currently.
The lineup has taken shape, pretty much fully. Now we've got a pre-show match and 9 main show matches. And I guess I want your opinion on the way they are utilizing the New Japan wrestlers, setting aside the hype and just how much they're throwing at people in this show. Just looking at the lineup and the developments that we got tonight, how do you feel about how things are shaping up?
I mean, I think they have some of them in great places on the card. I think, Tanahashi is, sort of emblematic of, New Japan's babyface fighting spirit. He's sort of wore that mantle for a long time. And so if you're looking at somebody on the New Japan card who's sort of a New Japan roster who's a foil for MJF, I think he's a good fit. Obviously, Ospreay and Omega have had a program going for a long time. Danielson and Okada is a long-time dream match, and I think the rest of it just kind of feels thrown together in a way. The Sonata and Jack Perry is kind of a random pairing. Punk being announced against Satoshi Kojima last minute was sort of a shocker. Like, it's his first singles match back, and it just kind of feels like he was just kind of announced with the same level of enthusiasm as some of the other undercard stuff. Shibata and Cassidy have some history together, so I kind of understand that pairing. So I guess I'd give it, half being used well and half that just kind of feel like they were randomly assorted onto the show.
I liked, when everything was going on with Blackpool, I was like, the hype at the end of this should be either for Omega Ospreay or Danielson and Okada. And they got there in the final moments. So I thought that was good. And they were declaring Danielson Okada as the main event. And so I think you want to end Dynamite with the main event, not an Eddie Kingston announcement about a gigantic tag match with a bunch of mixed signals about the Bucks and I don't like them, but you shouldn't boo them, that kind of thing. Like, it just, ending with Danielson and Okada, staring at each other, and then Okada hitting Wheeler Yuta with the Rainmaker, I think is a good way to end the show for both the casual fan who just kind of should see the crowd reacting and Danielson's reaction and Okada's presence and star power, but it also just emphasizes to the most likely audience to buy Forbidden Door on Sunday, which is the people who are going to look at this and go, okay, now I really got to see these two fight. I mean, I think they sort of had them sold before that, just when they announced the match. But seeing them in the ring and going, all right, we're just 5 days away, 4 days away, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 4 days away from the bell ringing and these two having potentially an all-time classic. That I give Tony Khan and the whole team credit for. That should be the closing image of Okada standing in the ring. He's the biggest star on the show from New Japan, and he should be center ring for the end. So I liked that. They had so much to cover. I mean, the Tanahashi thing, you know, Sean Radican texted me and said the best they could do is like this hostage video of Tanahashi. You know, it wasn't the thing to have Adam Cole basically the spokesperson for Tanahashi, but at least they got him on the screen. And then, you know, the Punk first singles match is just thrown in on a bracket announcement without much fanfare. Not sure how I feel about that. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of WWE-like. One might say the way they set up the four-way for the international title with the tag match that leads to a four-way. But, you know, you're trying to get a lot accomplished, and now you've said, all right, these four, and there was a miscue by Cassidy hitting Shibata that adds a little tension. Again, kind of WWE-like or Booking 101, but I thought that served its purpose well. And even we got a video package with Willa Nightingale and Tony Storm chatting about their match. So, I mean, it's not exhaustively everything that they did to promote this show, but they don't have significant matches on the lineup that they didn't set the stage for or preview or tease in some way tonight. So on the downside, there's just way too much thrown at us because they had so much to plug with Rampage and Collision, next week's Dynamite, the upcoming tournaments, all that. But on the bright side, they really did, I think, check every box as far as this lineup goes. And I think they have assembled a good lineup. I'm curious if there's criticism of the way that any of the New Japan talent is being used. Is there anybody, any match or anybody from New Japan in this lineup where you think there'll be some people going, wait, that wasn't a good use of that person, or they should have used someone in a different place?
I don't think so. I mean, I think they tried to match up high-profile New Japan talent with high-profile AEW talent, and that's really what you should expect from a co-promoted show like this. And so I don't think there's anything that stands out as like, oh, man, they really made an error here. And so I guess we'll have to see who fills in the gap in the six-man with Jericho, Guevara, and Suzuki and you know, join Sting and Darby Allin. So I'm assuming that's going to be another New Japan talent of some variety.
Yep, I agree. Okay, let's pause because I want to talk about CM Punk next, but let's introduce ourselves and invite our listeners to participate. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, June 21st, 2023. I'm Wade Keller, the host of the show, the editor, publisher, and founder of the long-running Pro Wrestling Torch weekly newsletter, launched in 1987, and also PWTorch.com, our main website with news, commentary, and live TV and pay-per-view coverage, including everything coming up this weekend with Collision and Forbidden Door. That's pwtorch.com, which was launched in 1999. And then I am the host of various podcasts, including the aforementioned Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast Tuesday Flagship with Jason Powell as my co-host this week. That's on our Blue Logo show right now. So search Wade Keller and subscribe to that. And also these post shows, which we now have a record 4 new shows per week, adding Collision to the mix on Saturday night. We went like 3 hours. We had on-site correspondence, lots of calls and emails, and just so much to talk about after that debut episode. If you haven't heard that yet, I encourage you to scroll down a little bit on this feed and download or stream that show to listen to our take on CM Punk's return promo and his return match and everything in between. The other voice you hear so far on tonight's show covering AEW Dynamite is Jake Barnett from ProWrestling.net, Jason Paul's website, and Jake is a contributor to written reports on the website and also their podcast. And Jake, it is great to have you back in the co-host chair for a Dynamite episode.
Always a pleasure, Whit. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Tell people a little more about what you do with ProWrestling.net and how they can hear more from you or read more from you.
Yeah, you can read me on Friday nights. I do the written reports for SmackDown and also the member exclusive audio reviews for SmackDown broadcast, as well as I join Jason Powell for several different types of podcasts. One is the .NET Weekly Audio Show, which is our flagship show that drops on typically on Thursdays, and then also
all right, Jake, I think we are back. We had a disconnection from the switchboard, but it looks like you are back with us. Hello, Jake.
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. Okay, so if you are live streaming our show and want to join this conversation, please call 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. That flags you on our switchboard so that we know you want to be brought onto the show. That is 347-215-8558. And we also are anticipating and hoping that Eric Kroll will be calling us. He was in attendance at Dynamite tonight. He's currently watching the Rampage tapings. He's going to try to break away. He wasn't 100% sure that he'd be able to do so, but we are anticipating that possibility. We also encourage you to email us, wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. Jake, before I move on with any calls or emails, I want to bring up CM Punk. He made an appearance on Dynamite, which, you know, instantly made me think, well, are they not doing this roster split of the top guys that they talked about, at least keeping Punk and his guys away from the Elite? And then he just said, hey, I'm not even supposed to be here. I'm a Collision guy. So it was sort of like, well, we're in Chicago and we're promoting Collision. So it seemed like it's probably just a rare or infrequent appearance by Punk and FTR in particular on Dynamite. But what did you think of Punk's second appearance on TV since his return here in Chicago?
I mean, it was fine. I think it got the crowd excited and set up a match for Collision, which he was keen to promote. I mean, I guess I wasn't shocked considering they were in Chicago that they found a way to get him on the show. And, you know, hopefully we don't hear about anybody, scrapping backstage afterwards, but I doubt that's the case. It seems kind of tossed together, the whole, Bullet Club Gold and the Guns and you know, kind of throwing them together with FTR and Punk and Starks. But it seems like a natural extension of a few things that they've been touching on since the last pay-per-view. So I guess it fits into their overall story structure. But it definitely needed something to headline Collision with this week after not really advertising anything for next week on the Saturday show. And I guess this was their way to go about going to do that. And I think Punk's doing fine in his appearances. I might not have, said everything that he said in his return fire promo on the opening of Collision, but I get the instinct to do so.
Elaborate on that, because I do want to get your thoughts on the first Collision in the totality of what Punk's done this week.
Yeah, I think I was talking with Zach Haydorn about it on Twitter while it was happening on Saturday. I guess my issue with it was that they spent so much time on the backstage issues that at least initially, it doesn't seem like they're going to be pursuing with any kind of angle or on-screen sort of antagonism, that it seemed like a waste of the opportunity that they had. Because I guess it remains to be seen how much, the audience that tuned in for Collision on Saturday remains for week 2 and week 5 and week 10 and all those things. But You had Punk coming back. It's his first promo back, and he spends the vast majority of it addressing something that's not going to be doing business for the company. And that's the thing that stuck out to me as being the potential negative. You know, he did talk about eventually going after MJF and all those things, but a lot of it was about the Bucks and Kenny, and I think he had to address it in some way, but I think it could have been a much smaller chunk of the promo that it actually ended up being.
Was there anything that stood out that if you heard him run down the promo before it went live, not that he thought of everything he was going to say, but let's say he did, you'd go, I'd scratch that. Like what stood out in that regard, other than just in general spending too much time on it?
I think most of it was actually fairly tame. I think the random line about David Zaslav and One Bill Phil probably would have been something that I left on the cutting room floor because it was just sort of an aside about nothing that didn't go anywhere because people were just left guessing what exactly he meant about it. But the whole fraudulent Bucks thing, the whole tell me when I'm telling lies act, I think is going to run thin real quick. So I'd probably have him steer away from that too, just because he basically is telling half truths while demanding that people let him know when he's lying. And so I guess that, it just doesn't come across as particularly genuine to people who have followed the story really closely. But, I mean, you can't really deny that he's a charismatic guy who's an excellent public speaker and knows how to get a crowd behind him. And so I think Punk is going to be somebody who shows up and has a high entertainment factor no matter what he's saying. But sometimes I just kind of roll my eyes at some of his lines.
Yeah, and there's a little bit of, you know, tell me when I'm lying. It's like, well, not, you know, truth isn't the be-all, end-all. Like, you know, you don't meet someone and go, you know, speak the truth but say something that makes them uncomfortable or seems inappropriate or, you know, just doesn't need to be bluntly said. And so there is a little bit of the foundation of it. It's not so much the lie that you're not lying. It's are you saying too much truth that rubs people the wrong way? And that is a bit of his reputation, you know, behind the scenes that, you know, when he is right and believes he's speaking the truth, there's not a filter and there's not, he's not willing to live with the consequences of that. And I mean, there's so much that's gone on with the Bucks and Kenny and Moxley and Jericho and Hangman. And then Punk and FTR on the other side of things, you know, there's layers of this we're not going to know, you know, that might never come out. Even in a tell-all book, there might be, you know, might be a he said type thing. But
and the truth is subjective. I mean, the truth truth is the truth from his perspective. And, you know, he's not exactly an impartial party to the incident or the aftermath. And so I think, you know, if the Bucks and Kenny are clearly never going to address this on screen, which it appears to be the case, you know, you're just sort of you're feeding the audience one person's version of the truth and then just kind of telling them to fill in the gaps with rumor, innuendo, you know, game of telephone, secondhand, thirdhand information. It's not a great position to be in.
Yeah. The fact that they managed to get them on the same show, even if they weren't at the same show crossing paths, I don't know when the Kenny Bucks Hangman thing was filmed or if they, you know, said film this early and go, I didn't find out when that segment with them was filmed, but they managed to get them all on the same show. So I guess that's good, but it does seem like with what Punk said, they'll be going back to, you know, Punk being a collision guy, as he said. I want to start with some emails here, and I actually want to start with Zach in Texas, who said, AEW is firing on all cylinders again. Dynamite was wild, chaotic fun from beginning to end. TK did a markedly better job intertwining Forbidden Door with ongoing AEW stories this year. And speaking of Forbidden Door, man, there are loaded cards, and then there's this Forbidden Door show. It's just an absurd amount of talent in one place. It's in the running for show of the year, and it hasn't even taken place yet. Also, I'm happy that TK brought the Lethal Lottery back and immediately went old school WCW Lethal Lottery as possible by teaming Cole and MJF. I just wish we could see the entire drawing televised. Seeing the wrestlers react to hearing their names called was always my favorite part of these shows. So first thing he said, you know, I don't disagree. There was wild chaotic fun for 2 hours tonight. And I do agree TK did a better job intertwining the New Japan talent in AEW for Forbidden Door this year. And I also believe it's a loaded show and certainly has a chance to be show of the year in the eyes of many, many fans. And you know, it'll be top contender. It'd be hard for it not to be with this lineup. So check, check, check. Agree with all that, Zach. The Lethal Lottery, Jake, wasn't – I mean, I think some people liked it, but it wasn't seen as, like, a great gimmick that was – I don't know. I mean, it was such a novelty, but – it wasn't like considered a high point of WCW when they introduced that, that whole concept. And it's a little cute, a little convenient that Cole and MJF were feuding were the first two names drawn out of that bin with, like, you know, however, you know, 100 little tumbler balls in it or whatever. You know, I mean, it's sort of, you know, not believable, you know, the idea that those would be the first two drawn. That set aside, if we stipulate to the coincidence of it, I thought Shivani not being able to hold back in revealing it and standing up and interrupting the segment was fun. You know, it's like, I just can't wait. I can't wait till next week. I got to say this now. I know we got another email on this and we'll get to it, but what do you think of bringing the Lethal Lottery back? Cause it would have been nice actually to explain it to the Dynamite audience, which it's like, there's this assumption that everybody knows what WCW did. It was sort of half explained, but not fully. But what do you think of that concept being back, the way they introduced it, and then kind of part two, the dynamic of Cole and MJF in that segment tonight? And like I said, I think we got at least one other email on that I might read in a moment.
I mean, they kind of put Cole in a weird position, right, where he's sort of encouraging MJF to accept the title match from another guy when he just spent the first several minutes of the promo, you know, sort of setting up the fact that he wants a rematch, which, you know, I guess, you know, maybe he's just way more confident than MJF seemed to be about beating Tanahashi and that whole thing. But I think the dynamic between the two of them, they clearly are both very good speakers, and they're two of the better actors in AEW. And so I think they elevate the content that they're given above maybe what it would have looked like on the page. They seem like they have good chemistry together. And so I understand why they would want to pair them together, because I think they do produce, you know, good television when they're on screen. I don't think the necessarily the content that they were given tonight was a home run. You know, it was, like you mentioned, it was a little bit tongue in cheek and too cute, and very convenient for their storytelling to have those be the first two balls out of the, you know, of the tumbler or whatever the case may be. But I, you know, the Lethal Lottery, man, put together a video or something. Like, this is, yeah. When did the Lethal Lottery actually come into existence? Like the early 90s, like Battle Bowl or something like that, I think was the first one, that Starrcade. It's like, this isn't something that people who are current in the wrestling, you know, world are necessarily going to be familiar with. So at least lay out the rules, explain what's at stake, and then start announcing teams. It felt like it was just, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like that shotgun blast of information where you could miss all the details if you weren't paying real close attention.
Yes, I agree. Well, let's read it. This is one of JB's points in his email. JB from Detroit said, was having MJF and Cole drawn as tag partners for the blind tag tournament a little bit too cute? So, yeah, I mean, there's creative license that you just sort of need to bake into pro wrestling, and everybody has a different point where it goes too far. And, you know, that's going to be different for different people. Sometimes you just, you know, you sort of take you take the bad in order to accomplish the good, just to put it simply. Like, okay, this is a little too convenient, but we want to get across the gimmick and the concept that there's going to be unlikely, unwanted tag team partners who are feuding or not likely to get along, and the novelty of seeing that is something to look forward to. And the first two names drawn are these two. It felt weird that we only saw two names being drawn on camera, and there wasn't like a big more drawings, and we didn't really know when the rest of the drawings would take place or why that one was filmed and why Tony couldn't reveal the names there. So there was a lot of things that were just sort of like done for the sake of getting from point A to point C, and they didn't care, you know, how they got there. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a little too cute. In the end, did it accomplish enough to be excused or at least mitigate how orchestrated and kind of, you know, cute and phony it felt? That's in the eye of the beholder, but I think I lean towards it being okay, even if it's worth pointing out, don't push it and make sure there's a point to it. But it really did establish what this is. Random draw. You're going to see people teaming who don't want a team, and that's how it works. So they should have done a better job explaining it up front. And maybe they could have drawn six names, like three pairs, and two of them are just ordinary. You know, like, no big deal. Oh, Orange Cassidy and Anthony Bones. Okay. That'll be a fun team, and then another team, and it's you know, John Silver and Trent Beretta. Oh, okay, that's random, but that's fine. And then MJF and Cole. Then it feels a little more natural. Then it's like, okay, it's not, what are the odds of the first one being the big news item? So something like that would have worked. It would have eaten up an extra 20 seconds of TV time, and Tony cares about every second of TV, and that's cutting into matches and other things he has to accomplish. So I'm not saying there isn't, quote, a downside, but I think that would have been worth it to make it feel like JB said, a little less cute. Jake, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I guess while you were you know, explaining your point there, I did a look up of the last time that the Lethal Lottery and Battle Bowl was used, and it was at the 1996 Slamboree event, which, I mean, there are probably a considerable portion of AEW's fan base that was not born when the 1996 Slamboree event took place. And so I think that's probably the best you know, reference that you can point to and say, hey, maybe this needed a little bit more explanation, because I'm sure there are a portion of AEW's fan base, and certainly, you know, Tyler, the first emailer, you know, was in the target market for, you know, who this was aimed at specifically, somebody who's going to get real jazzed when, you know, obscure wrestling stipulations from 30 plus years ago are announced. But I think the, you know, the majority of the audience are going to want at least a basic explanation. And whether it's a short video package or just Shivani sort of explaining the rules, that kind of stuff is important. And I think that's the kind of production touches that AEW loses out on sometimes with the pacing of these shows. There's just so much to go through all the time.
Yeah. I mean, there's something for a match where there's a chance to catch your breath and talk about stuff a little more casually, maybe not even the match in the ring, but some of these other things. Go, hey, while we have a moment here, you know, let's mention how this tournament works, and we understand Shivani's going to draw, you know, the first names of the first two teams, and then there'll be more drawings on Rampage or, you know, something like that. You can kind of fit that in the course of a casual conversation during a match. You don't want to do too much of that, but that might be a time where that would have made sense too. Okay, so JB's second question or point is, do you feel that the surprise of CM Punk showing up on Dynamite this week and setting up a match for Collision was a suitable reason for not heavily promoting this week's Collision on last Saturday's debut show? Interesting question. I thought of the same thing. They didn't do anything on Collision to hype next week's Collision, but as you watch how the show took shape, Saturday's episode of Collision, you can kind of see where a lot of it weren't things that they could talk about on Collision. And in Tony's mind, he probably didn't want a bunch of stuff being talked about on Collision because it would take away from the content, because he is so focused on those minute by minutes. And he knows that, you know, people do tune out once you start, you know, running down stuff and explaining things. And he just, you know, even though, you know, Collision was paced differently and a little bit slower, there's a little more breathing space. Maybe he didn't want to spend a lot of time trying to set up next week's show. Collision, by the way, features Punk and FTR and Ricky Starks against Jay White, Juice Robinson, and the Guns. They probably needed tonight's angle to establish that. Then you've got Swerve Strickland against Tanahashi. Maybe they could have announced that. Christian addressing the TNT title situation. They certainly could have mentioned that Saturday. And then Sting and Darby will reveal their partner. Well, they can't really reveal that until they did the follow-up on Dynamite tonight, I guess. And then Nyla Rose and Willow Nightingale, Brody King against Andrade are the other two or matches announced. They probably could have done that. But then you could go, well, is that a strong enough lineup to even be worth mentioning? You know, so, you know, if you imagine what Tony knew, what we know now that Tony knew then, I don't want to say like it's an egregious error that he didn't spend time specifically promoting what would happen, because some of it just hadn't been established yet. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess I think even announcing two, you know, matches that you could talk about is better than nothing. I mean, you can always, you know, do the old, well, tune in on Dynamite to hear more about what's happening on next week's Rampage, but, or, you know, on Collision. But I think my opinion just rests on, you know, you clearly had a couple of those things that you could have mentioned. And it's not that they're not worth, I mean, if they're not worth talking about, why are you booking them in the first place? You know, I think you should at least have the confidence that some of these matches that you're putting together matter enough to your audience that you can announce them a week ahead of time. Because it, if nothing else, it just gives people something to look forward to. Or, you know, maybe they will, you know, put the episode on their DVR if they hadn't, you know, fully committed to doing it before. Or any number of reasons why somebody might decide to tune in. So I don't think it means, you know, count on your audience showing up for the other 2 hours of your weekly product on Wednesdays to see if it's worth watching on Saturday. And maybe, you know, being in such a social media world, they just assume that people are going to get caught up there and then they'll be watching their socials throughout the week. And those assumptions are made, you know, in a lot of advertising you know, avenues at this point in time. But I still think it's worth talking about a couple of major matches. I mean, Swerve and Tanahashi, even if you would have been able to announce one match, that would have been enough for some of your, you know, your big core audience to want to tune in. And so that would have been worth saying at least.
Yep. All right, and then JB says, do you agree with the strategy of heavily promoting this year's Forbidden Door on the go-home show as opposed to last year, which basically spanned an entire month of June? What do you think of this year's build of Forbidden Door overall compared to last year's build? So we covered some of that in the opening segment, Jake, but I mean, it's everything certainly came to a crescendo tonight, and they have these competing things to promote, including, you know, trying to get a new TV show launched and trying to stay focused on that. Anything more you want to add to your assessment based on JB's framing of the question for and the job that they did this year compared to last year?
Well, I think a lot of the issues that they had with last year's show weren't necessarily that they, you know, they promoted it over the course of a month. It's that they just didn't have, you know, the same type of lineup that they have for this year's show. I mean, they had a lot of matches on last year's Forbidden Door, but it just didn't work out to have the marquee singles matches that you really want to see them promote over 3 or 4 weeks. Like I really would have liked to see them spend a lot more time establishing, you know, why Danielson and Okada are at odds with each other and why people consider them the two, you know, best wrestlers out of their respective generation, you know, and the same could be said for, you know, telling more of the story that Omega and Ospreay have been telling with each other, whether it's on social media or through their promos in New Japan or whatever the case may be. You know, those are your two matches, and you know that really are selling the show. And I just think they shortchanged them by trying to stuff the build into basically 2 weeks worth of time. But I do, you know, think that they managed to, like you said, touch on all the points that they needed to hit on tonight's show. It just felt like it was too compressed for my taste.
There's an argument to be made. You pick out two, maybe three matches on that show, and you spend the better part of 3 or 4 weeks just focusing on introducing who is Will Ospreay, what's his story, Okada, what's his story, and really the backstory of Omega and Ospreay and their you know parallel paths as two of the great workers of this generation, and then Danielson and Okada, and have Danielson in character, but you know also kind of straying from it a little bit. So the promo hits on two levels, talking about Okada and his history, and really turn him into a star. And then, I mean, those are the big two, and it's enough to, you know, sell pay-per-view for most people, but you could also do more with Tanahashi and MJF, and, you know, it is your world title, your world champion defending his title, and so you could tell the Tanahashi story too, and you know, I don't think even New Japan fans watching this really have any, could explain to a non-fan what the story is of Tanahashi getting this title shot, and how and why and what the significance of it is, and you know, at this stage of Tanahashi's career, what does this match mean? Is he favored? Is he not? Of course not, based on the AEW perspective. So if you kind of looked at those three and you said, that's your kind of 2.5 matches that, you know, using the WWE Kevin Dunn formula, you know, don't ask people to think about too much. You can announce the other matches, do angles for them, but, and even if it all comes together at the end, like tonight with some of the multi-person matches, fine. But focus and tell the story. There's such a great story to tell with Omega and Ospreay that's in people's heads who are fans of these wrestlers and have followed them, but they aren't told on television. And that's where, you know, the room for AEW's growth isn't further super serving the fans who love AEW and the things they do well matter way more than the things AEW comes up short on. And that's great for them. And AEW has a lot more of them than any other promotion has had in a very long time, other than WWE. You know, I mean, they can be profitable and successful by super serving the base core that they have. But the goal is growth. And this was a chance to sell the pay-per-view to more people by getting them emotionally invested in two or three of the key matches. And I guess that's what I would say to JB is, I think there's maybe a happy medium, and it's not about how many weeks are spent promoting the matches. It's more picking out two or three and spending more time on those, a disproportionate amount on those, and then moving to the other ones in a little briefer. And you know, tonight would have been fine for that. His fourth question, do you agree with the strategy of not presenting the Elite live on Dynamite this week as they're a babyface stable that would likely get booed in Punk's hometown? I think so. Jake, I mean, we got a little taste of that with Eddie Kingston in mentioning them and some booze and him trying to maybe blunt the booze a little bit. I think it makes sense because AEW does not want the Bucks and Kenny in Hangman to be booed. I mean, they want people to like Punk, they want people to like the Elite, and they want them to like them on separate days of the week and not feel like they have to choose. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the backstage thing was fine. Yeah, I guess if the overall approach is, you know, you want Punk to get the babyface reaction that he's going to get naturally in Chicago. You don't want to put the Elite in an unnecessary position of fighting against a hostile crowd. So you take the small step of just doing a backstage and protecting them in a lot of ways. And I think Kingston is so well respected by the majority of the AEW audience. You know, he's real. He's authentic. He's that guy. That I think they go along with him going out there and just, you know, telling him to chill out about the Elite. And so I think it worked out fine, just given the constraints that they were put in at this point.
Number five out of six, he says, will having AEW available 4 out of 5 days consecutively on pay-per-view weeks be sustainable in the long run? So we got Dynamite on Wednesday, Thursday off, Rampage on Friday, Collision on Saturday, and then the pay-per-view on Sundays. I would say it's not sustainable except for the fact that AEW doesn't run that many pay-per-views. I think it's 5 per year right now, with counting Forbidden Door. And so I think it's sustainable. I mean, it's a lot, but I mean, there's some AEW fans who are going to circle these weeks on their calendar as one of their favorite weeks of the year. And it's a lot, and I think, you know, I think the downside is just the fact that while they're promoting the pay-per-view, especially early on with Collision, while also trying to not make Rampage feel like it's just been forgotten or it's more skippable than ever, I think Tony's feeling pressure to promote Rampage and, oh, MJF's first appearance ever on Rampage and a whole lineup there, and then promote Collision. And also, don't forget about Dynamite next week when we shift away from all the New Japan stars. It's not that it's not sustainable for the viewer who's a hardcore Arden fan. I think it's just tough in terms of ultimately taking away from the pay-per-view hype because there's so much that they're throwing at you.
Yeah, it's a lot of hours of content. And I guess if you don't want to present any of them as like optional, right? I mean, that's the tough part. Like you're building 5 hours of television content, and then you're probably going to have somewhere between 4 and 5 hours of content on Sunday night. And that's a pretty intense commitment for your fan base if you want them to watch all of the hours of your show. And so I think you have to strategize, you know, where are you going to put your segments that have a high impact on the pay-per-view? And I think tonight they decided to move the Danielson call out of Okada to the main event, primarily because they wanted to try to hold on to that audience. I mean, if you look at the quarter hours for Dynamite last week, it was basically downhill from Q1 all the way to the end of the show. And I think they want to try to turn that stuff around. I think they have a tough battle ahead of them. It's just a lot. It's a gauntlet of content from AEW on pay-per-view weeks. And really every week. I mean, 5 hours of TV is a lot for anyone to try to fit into their life. And, you know, I think Rampage has bore, you know, will continue to bore the brunt of that going forward. I wouldn't be shocked if AEW gets its renewal from Warner Brothers, you know, Turner at the end of this year, early next year, and it's for 5 hours of content. That fifth hour stops being Rampage and it starts becoming some sort of reality show or something. I just can't imagine them wanting to continue to produce that show with the numbers that it's turning in week after week.
Yep. All right. And then he concludes, is heavily promoting and basically introducing both the blind tag and this year's Owen tournaments on such a packed show the best idea? As always, love the show and go VIP. Yeah, so the issue isn't that the Owen Hart tournament is a good or bad idea. It's that they're introducing it, and I get the timing, as they're about to tour Canada. So was it – I mean, it didn't take up a lot of time, but it is part of just again, adding so much, bombarding viewers with so much information. The timing is unfortunate that you have the Tour of Canada for the beginning of Collision, and you want to do the Own Heart Tournament in Canada, and I get all that, and it just happens to be starting the weekend that you're also trying to promote episode number 2 of Collision, try to keep Rampage relevant, and yes, Forbidden Door, a pay-per-view where, you know, financially it's important for AEW for it to do well. I'm not sure I would have voted against putting the brackets up, but there's a big downside to it, which is it's a lot. And then having a concept, you know, the blind tag tournament, the lottery tag teams adds, you know, that might be the thing to maybe think twice about because you're throwing so much at people. But I do think it explains why they did the finish last week between MJF and Cole and wanting to have a reason that they can move to, you know, that they aren't going right to announcing a match, a rematch, but instead now they're going to be sidetracked by having to team together. And, you know, the unlikely tag team who bicker, it's a trope in wrestling. And I think these two personalities can succeed in telling that story. And to tell that story, you need to have the blind eliminator tag team tournament going on. So every one of them can be justified individually, Jake. I'm not disputing that. But in the end, maybe the tough choices should be cutting something or delaying something or just not doing what normally would be smart, which is promoting something in order to, you know, have more focus.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Owen tournament is something that they've been talking about for weeks and weeks now. It was, I think the blind tag eliminator is something that they very well could have put off until next week to announce. And it felt like they, you know, they fit it into this show because they wanted to come up with a reason for Cole to be responsible for MJF accepting the Tanahashi match, when I think that there was a much more direct way to, you know, to get around that. But, you know, it, you know, it, what's done is done. And hopefully going forward, they, you know, they find a way to pivot to something where they give things a little bit more time to breathe. I think the idea that all of this needs to be fit into this show because you have all these priorities and you have to serve them all at the same time. You know, that's, it's a sign to me of somewhat indecisive booking where you feel like everything you're doing is so critical and so important that you can't sacrifice any of it. And I think that's a way to lead yourself into situations where all of it feels less important than it should. And you know, that's a dangerous place to be. I mean, you don't want so much going on that none of it feels important. And I think they took away from some of their marquee matchups for this pay-per-view by sacrificing so much time in the middle of the show to advertising everything else that was going on.
All right, up next, Azan in St. Louis says, could you see Jushin Liger as a third man on Sting's team?
That'd be great to see Liger again. I think he's retired, though. I mean, officially retired. Maybe he'd come back for one more match if the money and everything was right. But, yeah, I guess we'll have to see what shakes out. If I'm New Japan, I'd probably want it to be somebody who was on my active roster that could get a little bit of a rub from it.
Yeah, yep. Then where do you see the relationship between John Moxley and Eddie Kingston going down the line? What do you think, Jake?
I think, you know, it's they're on a path to conflict. You know, I guess we'll have to see if they have them, you know, fit into a singles feud in AEW, or if, you know, Moxley heads over to ROH, if Eddie's able to, you know, to capture that world championship from Claudio. I guess there's a lot of potential options there. But, I mean, if I was going to pick my preference, I'd love to see them hash out a feud on AEW TV where they both get considerable promo time because they're two of the most entertaining promos in the company.
Yes, yes. Good to have Eddie back. I liked him just kind of peeking at the camera when he turned around and then going, I'm not here to volunteer. I'm not here because I want to team with these people, but then explaining himself. I thought there were layers of complications but logic to it. And I like the quick little references to the Bucks and Moxley about their past. It'd be, they deserve credit for acknowledging that because they easily could have not, and people would be like, wait a second, we're just supposed to forget about all that stuff. So that's good. As far as where it goes, I don't know that there's a lot more after after the show. Well, I don't know. Yeah, I haven't. I'd have to think about it. Where there's so many, everything is going in so many different directions. I'm not even sure what'll be next for Blackpool when this is done either. I don't have a clear idea of that. Number three. Go ahead, three. Yeah.
No, I think Blackpool is a lot more valuable to AEW apart as singles acts than they are together as a faction long term. So I mean, I hope the path is eventually, you know, it ends up getting, they just go their separate ways or it dissolves somehow, because factions are interesting, but they become less interesting the more people in the company that are a part of them, and there's just too many of them in AEW at any one time.
Yep. And then finally, is it a good move by Tony Khan to use the Felix and Oscar of AEW, now Adam Cole and MJF, to bring viewers to Rampage? I mean, I guess tone-wise, MJF has done a wide variety of tones. He's done dances and singing and dancing, and then he also is lewd and you know, crossing the line of what anyone else says on TV. And then sometimes he's just the traditional wrestler, and other times he's revealing he's this longtime wrestling fan, and other times he's a more traditional, just, you know, Luthez-like champion who just wants to be respected and be seen as an all-time great. He plays all these different roles, so he can do that. With Adam Cole, I don't know if it's best or not for his character to be doing this, but, I mean, I don't want to prejudge. I guess I don't have a strong feeling against it so far. Jake?
Well, I guess what's the alternative to get Adam Cole his title match? You know, I think they've probably heard the criticism that has been floating around for, you know, I don't know, at least a year, that all of MJF's opponents have sort of followed this pattern of going through some sort of gauntlet of impossible tasks, you know, a match with him at some future point. And rather than doing that, they're following a different pattern. They've announced this, you know, lethal lottery tournament, and they're putting those two together. And it's a different way to end up at the same place. And so I guess there's something to appreciate in the novelty of it. You know, whether it ends up being 100% successful, well, I guess we're going to have to wait until, I guess, all in or all out. I guess it depends on when that title match actually happens.
Okay, let's bring on Eric Kroll. He is on site at Wintrust Arena in Chicago. Eric, PW Torch contributor, great to have you on. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, Wade, and I'm sorry, Jake, co-host? Yep.
Jake Barnett, yep.
So I have news here from Rampage.
Yeah,
so they will be spoilers.
We love that.
There was some news. MJF and Adam Cole continue their odd couple act, and MJF thanked Adam Cole for helping him get the confidence to accept the Tanahashi match, and MJF said he helped Cole get a match so he wouldn't be left off Forbidden Door, and it's against Filthy Tom Lawler, and then Lawler came in and attacked Cole from behind, and Lawler and a henchman beat him up, and MJF did a comedy routine of, I'm going to come help you, partner, really slowly walking to the ring. Almost there. Oh, just missed them, right? So they were continuing that angle. And then we had one of the worst segments in AEW history. I don't know how it's going to come across on TV, but this was horrible. So the Acclaimed win a quick squash with Billy Gunn, and Harley Cameron, the sort of busty woman, tanned Australian English accented woman from QTV, comes out with two henchmen wearing white horror masks and black hoodies. And she asks to join the Acclaimed and sings and raps. And you couldn't hear her because the crowd was booing her. And this was not, we think you're a good heel heat. This was go away heat, like the whole crowd. And nobody's left here of the 6,000, although they did after this segment. And QT Marshall comes out after the Acclaimed reject her. At some point, Anthony Bowen says, "Oh, you think I'm into you? Listen, honey, I'm gay." So there was a lot going on here. None of it was good, although at least Anthony Bowen's got a baby face pop for revealing that he was gay. Of course, the one of the masked guys turns out to be the re-debuting John Morrison, who attacks Billy Gunn from behind. So as the Acclaimed were running up the ramp against QT and Aaron Solo. So it was horrible. It was terrible. Harley spoke in such a high-pitched voice, you couldn't understand what she said, and the crowd was booing her so loudly, you couldn't hear what she said. But they have to – I don't know how they're going to edit this on TV, but they should edit it down. And Billy Gunn was standing there with the mic saying, hey, I don't really think they're into you, honey. So anyway, that's the news I have.
I hope they air it unedited. You've just sold me.
Oh, yeah. It was the shit. So anyway, how's it going? What can I answer? What questions can I answer for you?
Well, you know what we like to talk about, but I guess my question is, one, how full was the arena? Excalibur said it was a sellout. Tell us how full it really was.
Oh yeah, it was full. There were over 6,000 fans. There were some empty seats behind the hard cam. So it was close to a sellout, you know? But there were, you know, scattered empty seats. But, you know, they since Punk's collision appearance on Saturday, I think they might have sold 1,200 tickets, something like that. So Punk was a difference maker here tonight at the box office. Punk got the loudest pop, of course. Go ahead.
That was my question, is how big was Punk's pop compared to what you expected, what he got Saturday, and compared to the next biggest pop among AEW wrestlers. We'll get into New Japan in a moment.
So Punk's pop was not as loud as Saturday, but that's because there were about 3,000 or more fewer people in the building, and they didn't play his music at the start. He just came down to the ring, and so that probably contributed to less of a pop. They went to ad break. Punk did parade around Ricky Starks. He like raised his hand, pointed at Ricky Starks' ab, and the crowd chanted Ricky. So Punk was trying to get Ricky Starks over with the crowd. So that was nice to see. And the Bucks got booed a little bit when they came out on the screen for that pre-tape with Eddie Kingston. The crowd was so good tonight, they even stuck with that women's match that I didn't think was that great because Taya was on offense for most of it, and she's not very good. Crowd was really in Eddie Kingston. He probably got the second biggest. His pop might have rivaled the crowd reaction to him might have rivaled Punk, you know, slightly behind.
Wow.
And big pop for MJF when he comes out, like, pop, like, we're really happy to see you. You're a great star. Like, it, too, probably was rivaling Punk. But, you know, of course, MJF heals right away and gets the crowd to boo him with, you know, the lowest common denominator stuff that he resorts to about fat Midwesterners and the like. Suzuki was incredibly over, you know, fairly loud murder grandpa chant. Okada got an even bigger reaction than Eddie Kingston. Crowd, everybody knew who he was super into him. Yeah, that was the pops.
Jake, jump in with a question or topic for Eric to bring up from his attendance tonight.
Yeah, I'm curious what happened to the Hardys because they disappeared after the beatdown, and then they did not reappear for like the celebration with Punk and FTR and Ricky Stark. So they just bail the ringside and stay there.
Yeah, we too were looking for them during the saves, and you know why weren't they standing tall with the rest? My best guess is they flunked back down the side, not up the ramp, but you know right by the ramp where the wrestlers sometimes go back while everybody was distracted. Which is certainly a curious choice. They got they got beat, and then they didn't get a chance to get any heat back. They didn't get to celebrate with the baby faces or help save them from the beatdown.
What was the pop for the Hardys like?
Kind of mid, not great. It's really hard to watch Matt Hardy in the ring these days. He barely moved, right? I mean, on the hot tag, he was, you know, the guns were doing a great job bumping and feeding him, but he just really didn't do much. It's kind of sad to see.
Yeah. The crowd seemed brilliant to chanting delete, but it was all the guns. Austin and Colton are just so good at their bumps. And, you know, they walked that line, maybe crossed it a little bit in terms of some comedic aspects to their, you know, spaghetti legs and bump taking. But, man, do they hit the mat hard. And I mean, they're the right opponents if they want to make the Hardys look passable at this point with everything going on with them, with all the wear and tear on them.
Yeah.
How did the crowd? Oh, go ahead, Eric. Bring up what you're.
Nope. Going. Go ahead.
Okay. How did the concession stand brawl work out? Speaking of, you know, I mean that was pretty slapstick in certain ways. Not meant to be taken seriously. There's nothing about Sanjay Dutt's act that's any, you know, meant to be taken seriously. It just feels like it's in a different realm of AEW's universe than just about everything else on the show. How did that come across in the arena?
So they started up on the concourse, and it was hard for people to see unless you were sitting over by that side, stage right, I think, up on the 100 level, which is, you know, the concourse was elevated from where the ring was, obviously, because it came down the stairs. You know, it wasn't my kind of thing. I didn't think, as far as concession stand brawls go, I don't think it's making them out Rushmore. And
crowd was
into it, though. Yeah, the crowd was into it, though. They were, you know, people started getting antsy when it was a 4-on-1 beatdown and they were waiting to see who would make the save. I mean, it was what it was. The crowd was very generous tonight. I mean, they reacted to everything and were loud for everything. Even stuff that, like, you know, parts of the women's matches didn't necessarily deserve it. So it's an easy crowd here in Chicago.
That's the thing. That, you know, we've seen this alignment with AEW and WWE where I think instead of fighting what the companies are doing, each fan base, and obviously there's an overlap, but each fan base just wants to like what their brand is doing because they've taken sides, or more than taken sides, the brand has earned goodwill with them. And so they'll take the kind of variety hour mix and match of what AEW is doing and be into it. And, you know, Tony Khan is promoting it because he's hearing these crowd responses. And I think, you know, pretty consistently, Jeff Jarrett, you know, is a master of his craft in getting crowd reactions. What else stood out on the show, just generically speaking, in terms of the job they did hyping Forbidden Door tonight compared to what they've done in recent weeks? And compared to last year, I know you're in the building, you're not hearing the announcers and all that, but did things kind of fall into place in a good way for you? Do you think they hit a crescendo going into the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, they announced some matches, right? They announced a pretty fairly significant match with the Elites versus BCC. They announced another match, GM Cole, Filthy Tom Lawler match here during Rampage, and they, you know, they had the nice go home angle at the end, and just, you know, I know probably, you know, the casual fan that everybody's chasing is sitting at home thinking, who's Okada? But the crowd here knew him, right? I mean, you don't get as loud of a pop as he did if they don't. And so that's, you know, I guess that could be just a testament to last year or to the AEW fan base, you know, being knowledgeable about wrestling beyond their home promotion.
Jake, you want to jump in with another question for Eric?
I was curious about some of the reaction for the Lethal Lottery tournament. Did most people know what the heck that was and what they were drawing numbers for out of the Tumblr, or was there a lot of confusion in the crowd?
I was confused. You couldn't – often you can't hear what they're saying on the screen either because the crowd is being loud or the sound is kind of funky, and it was kind of funky. I couldn't really hear what Tony Schiavone and RJ City were saying. So I still don't know what the thing is sitting here now. I'm hoping to find out when I get home and watch the tape.
Well, you're not going to get any more information. There's a Tumblr with every wrestler's name in it. Tony's drawn about two at a time, and those two wrestlers have to team up randomly in a tournament, and WCW did that decade. So there you are. You're caught up.
Okay.
Eric, what was your reaction like for Chris Statlander?
He was good. She
yeah.
She was over. she was actually doing moves unlike her opponent, you know, that were connecting with the fans. Right now, Jungle Boy's in the ring against Juki from New Japan. And you would not think Juki would be over, but he's over. He's getting a Juki chance. So you can hear the big crowd pop. Statlander, I was worried. She did a move off the apron, like that involved a somersault, it looked like, and I was worried she was going to hurt herself. I mean, it was a really cool-looking move sitting there live. She was over when just about everybody's over. It's hard to stand out, you know, in that way. But better to be over than not over.
Yeah. Yes. Did Tony Khan make any appearances that you've seen now?
Yeah, he came out right before the show with about 90 seconds before we went on the air. And, you know, just it is, I'm from Illinois, Chicago, you know, Illinois is so important to me. I don't know if he called it AEW's home base, but, you know, something to that effect. And then he came out again after Dynamite wrapped, but before Rampage started, to get, ask people to stay for Rampage, and he announced the matches. I think a bonus match that they're going to tape, I think he said Vikingo and Commander were going to be involved in some sort of match. I couldn't hear Tony at that point because I wasn't close enough. As you can tell, yeah. Jungle Boy appears to have had a successful match against Stokey. So,
what was I just going to ask about Rampage, Tony Khan? Oh, I know. This is only tangentially related. The Young Bucks and Kenny and Hangman, when they appeared on the screen, get a certain type of reaction from the crowd? A notable reaction?
Yeah, they got booed, but it wasn't as bad booze as I thought it would be.
Yeah.
But the crowd booed him, for sure.
Same thing when Eddie brought him up and he tried to play a little damage control. I don't like him or respect him, but they're good guys. Like, he was trying to kind of, you know, mitigate, you know,
right,
things getting too out of hand in Chicago, it sounded like, yeah.
It wasn't like Saturday when there were FC Elite chants, right, at certain times during the show.
Right.
Yeah.
Go ahead with any additional spoilers from Rampage, and we'll consider this a warning for people who want to watch it without knowing the outcome.
Okay.
Just they can hit fast forward for a couple of minutes.
Jungle Boy beat Doki. I didn't see it because I was in the talking to you guys. But now that Jungle Boy has won, Sonata, the IWGP Heavyweight Champion, is in the ring confronting him, and Sonata's dressed in a suit, and they're having a stare down. Sonata looks like sort of like an airline pilot, I would say, sunglasses, aviators, and a blue suit. And Sonata's pop, you can probably hear it in the background, not as loud as, you know, Okada or Suzuki or even, you know, so, which about fits where Sonata is in New Japan right now, I would say. There was a dark match taped before we got going, a three-way with Hikaru Shida, Mei Suruga, and Emi Sakura, and the heels beat up on Shida for a while. It was only about 6-7 minutes, and then the heels ended up turning on each other when one of them tried to pin the other, when Suruga tried to pin Emi, and Shida hit a weak-looking kick on Suruga for the pin. You probably won't get to see that unless AEW gets a streaming service, because it was the dark match. The first match of Rampage was United Empire, Jeff Cobb, Kyle Fletcher, and Will Ospreay, who Ospreay was super over, and Swerve Strickland, and they took on Best Friends Rocky Romero and Yo from New Japan, and Ospreay beat Yo with the Hidden Blade in about 8-9 minutes. And it was, you know, a lot of action. Pretty good match, worth seeing. Sky Blue defeat in her hometown, defeated Anna Jas to advance in the quarterfinals of the Owen Hart Memorial Tournament. So those are your Rampage results so far. And it looks like the Ring of Honor wrestling logo is up on the screen. So it is possible that this Vikingo Commander match that they're involved in is going to be a Ring of Honor taping match. Yeah, they are changing out the ring, the apron to the ROH branding. So that'll be it for Rampage, and we'll get a special bonus match taped for Ring of Honor. And if you read my report on PWTorch.com about the Ring of Honor taping from the United Center Saturday in Chicago, you will know that was a grueling death march of a taping. That's just boring and brutal, and it's like a dark taping that just stretches on and on.
Yeah.
But this has promised to be a pretty good match, so I am excited to see it in a few minutes when they get started. Here's Tony Khan is out now. One last match for you. Let's see what he says.
We can kind of hear him here.
Yeah. Before I started AEW, I went to All In, Tony Khan says. We've sold well over 65,000 tickets to All In London.
Yeah.
I purchased Ring of Honor. Some of the greatest luchadors in the world coming out. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, that's about it. Tony Khan went
back.
He didn't.
Yeah.
He did not announce All Out, or that All Out would be taking place in Chicago, as far as I heard.
Yeah.
So, it's a mystery. So, yeah, that's about it from here.
My last question for you, and then you can get to watching them set up the ROH logos again. Was there any reaction or reactions that surprised you, especially louder or less than you expected, New Japan or AEW wrestlers? Just anything notable in that way?
No, I mean, to me, the thing that was surprising is the crowd was so loud throughout the whole show. I would describe it as a very generous crowd. And I think that might have to do with the fact that they didn't try and cram in 7 AEW Dark Elevation matches before the show started. We just got that 1 6-7 minute women's three-way. And so the crowd was, you know, you have more energy. And there was more energy for Rampage here in the background than in previous shows I've been to, where they get to rant, they do the Hour of Dark Elevation, they do Rampage, and everyone's exhausted by the end of Rampage.
Yep. All right, very good. Eric, we'll let you go and enjoy the what I think might be the last match of the night for you. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, I'll file a report with the results when things wrap up.
Awesome. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, bye.
All right, Jake. Any thoughts on anything Eric had to say?
I guess the it's interesting to hear that the All Out situation hasn't been confirmed yet. They always promise that show would remain in Chicago, or at least Tony Khan has said that before. So I guess I'm still waiting for that mystery to unravel. But they've done a lot of things in Chicago recently, so we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. Yep. All right, another email here. James in Clemson says, I just have to get this off my chest. I can't stand the Young Bucks. And this is not Eddie Kingston. This is James in Clemson. After 3.5 years, I still have no clue who these guys are because they can't be bothered to cut a promo. They're lazy, and I 100% side with Punk. I really hope they go to WWE so they can learn what a promo is. I'm curious of your opinion, and if you were to build a tag division, would you take the Young Bucks or the Usos? Jake, answer what James asked, but also give your assessment of the Punk Elite feud and your take on kind of where you think things stand and how it is being handled right now by everybody involved, including Tony Khan.
I mean, I continue to be a little confused about where it actually does stand because, you know, there's a lot of reporting happening saying that things are as bad as they've ever been. And then there's other conflicting reports that, you know, everything is sort of rolling off the Bucks and they're not, you know, they're not as wound up as a lot of people say that they are. And so I honestly don't know what to believe at this point, but I think, you know, the emailer's points are well taken to a degree. I don't think the Young Bucks have been as interested in developing their characters as I would have thought they would have been. You know, they essentially launched the company on the back of, you know, the being the Elite and their success in New Japan and putting All In together. And that didn't really lead them to more ambition, you know, further expansion of their characters in a televised format, you know, in front of a much larger televised audience. They sort of shrunk into, you know, back onto YouTube and the content that they had, you know, total control over. And so that part of it, I completely understand why people would be frustrated with the Young Bucks. I mean, they continue to deliver fantastic matches. And I guess if that's really all that you are counting on them for or interested in them producing, then maybe you're satisfied with their act. But I certainly was hoping for more when AEW launched and we didn't get it. You know, if I was going to pick one of the two teams that were offered to start a tag division, it's the Usos, hands down. I don't think, you know, the last 24 months of their careers could cause you to make any other choice. I mean,
no.
I mean, and that's not necessarily like a statement that the Young Bucks don't have value or something like that. It's far from the truth, but I wouldn't make the choice, you know, to side with the Young Bucks if I was only given one of those two teams. Now, you know, if they're ever in the same company, would I book a feud between them? Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely would.
All right. Let's go to Bryant in Boston, who is calling us with some thoughts on tonight's Dynamite. Bryant, welcome. Brian's right there. Hey, Brian. Yep, you're up.
I think there was a little bit of a cutout or something. I thought Dynamite, it wasn't nearly as good as last week, in my opinion, but it was good. I mean, the start of the show was pretty good with the tag team match. I thought there was some good storytelling there with Bullet Club Gold and the Guns kind of meshing together. And then I was really hoping they would get the win because they need it. They're a young and up and coming team. The Hardys are way over the hill, but a victory over them still means something. And, you know, to be honest, Jeff Hardy, I'm concerned for the guy's welfare, you know, especially when his whisper in the wind doesn't look nearly as good as it used to. But what were you guys' thoughts on the opening tag match and just the kind of storytelling there? I thought it was pretty good and kind of set up some factions and some possible feuds going forward.
Yeah, I mean, the Hardys, I don't think Jeff Hardy can go to Canada, so we're not going to see much of him for a while here. It has brought up on commentary that, you know, Jeff was a half step off or had ring rust, but he seems to have worked it off now. You know, Jake, you talked earlier about, you know, Matt being very limited in his movement. And, you know, Jeff's not physically, you know, in the same place, maybe mentally, you know, timing wise, I guess, more than physically sharp to do what he used to do. And I mean, you know, is it at a point where you got to protect him and put him out there in six mans, or I don't know. But I think the Hardys being utilized this way is not good as a team. I think having the Hardys advertised where it's a really big deal if they wrestle and it's sort of a dream match and you sort of hope for the best, but you don't put them out there on TV a lot and expose them, and they're treated more as special attractions at this point, I think has more value than just, you know, having them out there on TV a lot. I just think fans, I mean, there's a nostalgia pop for them and an appreciation for them, but AEW doesn't need them. You know, he doesn't need the Hardys act to be just utility guys being used in circumstances that don't feel really special. So to me, I mean, Matt's practically, you know, relegated himself to being a manager at times. And then now he's back trying to be the Hardy boys again. And there comes a point where it's, I don't know, I don't want to be, you know, too negative with descriptions, but I mean, people are going to watch and go, these guys don't have it anymore. And it's kind of time to move on. You know, there was a point with Rock and Roll Express where it got that way, and then they kind of, you know, turned into a nostalgia act entirely, and I don't know. I mean, it's, yeah, I just, if the Hardys, you know, have a dream match here and there against established teams, and it's, they make a big deal out of it and treat it as special, to me, I like that better than what they're doing. Jake, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement. They should be a special attraction at this point. I don't think they're physically capable of hanging with the rest of the tag division in a way that justifies them being on television every week, but they do have name value and they do get a great pop. And so, you know, use them judiciously in a way that maximizes their talent without putting their health at risk and the health of the people that they're in the ring with.
Brett, what else?
I thought the concession stand brawl was a waste of time. That first of all, like half the match took place in the ring. Like the whole point of the concession stand brawl is to have it take place in the outside. And, you know, just a matchup between, I mean, I like Mark Briscoe, but Mark Briscoe and Jeff Jarrett, that should be something relegated to Rampage. I just thought there could have been some better use of the time. And it just, a match like that is supposed to feel like a big blow off to an important feud or something, but I didn't really feel any importance to this or anything. I just thought it was a big cluster F, so to speak. And, you know, you could have had that time for House of Black or, you know, just other talents that aren't used as well as they should be. So I'm just wondering if you guys felt the same way.
Jake.
Yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of the concession brawl, and the fact that it migrated to the ring and it continues the pattern of Jeff Jarrett's overbooking of everything. You know, everything involves 15 people. It feels very late stage TNA in a bad way. You know, when he was still involved there. And it's, you know, I guess that style of booking has followed him around since Memphis, more or less. But it doesn't seem to jive with what the rest of AEW is doing. And I think it feels very much like something that could have been cut from the show and more time could have been given to other more important segments that were relevant for Forbidden Door. You know, this is very much a feud that could take place on ROH if they wanted to move basically everybody associated with this feud over there. And it would feel right at home.
Brian, anything else you want to bring up?
Maybe just one more thing, because I know you guys are kind of pressed for time. The Adam Cole MJF segment, you know, I thought it was pretty good between the two guys, but I just wonder what your take was on them kind of extending the storyline a bit and kind of not, you know, blowing the match off really quickly by having them sort of as uncomfortable bedfellows in a tag team. I thought it was, I didn't really like the way it was delivered by Tony Schiavone. I mean, it should have, this is kind of why they need like a small authority figure, like someone who can deliver, you know, someone who can come out and deliver messages or something and not look like a, I don't know, not look like a ham, but I thought it was interesting. I actually kind of like the idea because it's been used before and, you know, it's kind of cliche, but I think it could work and kind of extends it out to hopefully you know, like All Out or All In, either one. So I'm just, where were you guys' thoughts were, and I'll hang up and take the answer. Have a good night.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. So what do you think, Jake, of how Tony Schiavone comes across in these podcasts? I think fans like him. I think he's likable. You know, he's not, they don't lean on him on commentary for a lot. What are the pros and cons of Tony being, you know, one of the faces of the announced team for Dynamite?
Well, I think he's, you know, he adds value in the sense that he's a legacy act that a lot of people have, you know, warm feelings for, you know, going way back to calling Nitro. But I, you know, he's certainly not like the most dynamic performer when it comes to, you know, being an actor. And if he has to really integrate himself into a feud, or, you know, be a character that's being an antagonist or whatever the case may be. So I think, you know, that there are some pros and cons to him being the guy who's always delivering announcements. I talked to Jason Powell about this last week on our .NET Weekly show about how I think they missed an opportunity with Jeff Jarrett to use him as a babyface authority figure of sorts, instead of introducing him as a heel talent. You know, he could have been somebody with a level of authority who has decades of history in wrestling, who could have just played it straight as a, you know, as a babyface authority figure with credibility, who didn't choose sides, who tried to call things down the middle. Now, whether they had, you know, it didn't seem like that was ever the plan, but I think it is a bit, you know, overwrote to have your announcer constantly standing up and acting like he has the direct beam satellite in from Tony Khan, who's making announcements. I think the company would be better off if they delegated that to an authority figure of sorts. And I don't know who you choose for that at this point, but I don't know that Schiavone is necessarily the person that I would choose.
All right. Just a few other aspects of Dynamite here. Jericho and Sammy teaming up, did you, with Minoru Suzuki, but did you get any sense of how Guevara felt about teaming with Jericho? And is this, are they kind of playing it low key because they're eventually heading towards, Guevara, you know, perhaps, Guevara and Suzuki getting fed up with Jericho, at Forbidden Door, or just Sammy, like any hints of where things might be going? Is there a point where, like, is the to be announced in the end possibly going to be Guevara switching sides when the bell rings or something like that?
I guess that's entirely possible, but I would think the idea here is that they didn't go out of their way to give us any hints now, because they want the big surprise to be during that announcement on Collision, and to, for that to be, you know, an extra push for, you know, for the Forbidden Door show. So I guess we'll see who is announced at Collision as being the TBA. And if that means, you know, Guevara switches sides and that gives Suzuki and Jericho 24 hours to find a fill in, then that can be it. But they did, you know, in the lower third, when Jericho and Guevara were making their entrance, they did go out of their way to point out that they had been together since the first episode of Dynamite. And so clearly they're planting seeds about this story being paid off at some point, but it just wasn't on this show.
How are you feeling about Chris Statlander's run as TBS champion and the kind of total lack of any follow-up with Jade Cargill, other than she was in the background when Don Callis was hanging out backstage?
Yeah, that's been a little puzzling, but maybe they have a different type of reintroduction and character in mind for Jade Cargill upon her return. You know, I guess this is the first time that she has ever had a chance to show off some humility or self-reflection or self-awareness or any of those things. You know, she's just been unstoppable since day one, and this is a sort of a rare opportunity for her to show some growth as a character. And so I'm curious to how she shows back up. But Statlander's title reign
It's been fine, but it's mostly just been a series of decent television matches. They're not going out of their way to tell stories with her, and I think that's a problem with the women's division in general.
Yes. The other topic I want to bring up is just the follow-up with Don Callis, who I just mentioned. Jay Cargill's in the background of, and Don Callis and Takeshita, you know, presenting themselves backstage during the Blackpool Combat Club segment because some wrestlers have other things going on. How do you grade or how do you evaluate what we've seen with Callis and Takeshita since the big angle? Because to me, with everything going on, I feel like there's some lost momentum. I think Callis turning on Omega should have been this huge deal. And kind of the first follow-up to it, or the second follow-up to it at this point, is just Callis offering to help out his Omega's opponent, who he's not affiliated with, who's leery of dealing with him. I mean, they can rev this up again, but it does feel like they're going to have to rev it up because it did lose some momentum. An angle of that level, when you've got the manager of the former world champion who are so tied together, and the last couple of weeks, everything's just, to me, has cooled off. And I understand the circumstances of the schedule and the timing, but it doesn't feel like it is where it should be based on after the initial angle.
Yeah, it kind of feels like we're on a bit of a diversion, a detour of sorts. You know, I think the end goal is going to be, you know, Takeshita and Omega at a major event, you know, whether it's the upcoming All Out or All In, one of those two, you know, it could fit in on either show depending on how they design that card. But, you know, this is just feeling like a setup for, you know, Takeshita and Callis to get involved in the Osprey and Omega match to get, you know, the desired finish there so that they can have their third match at Wrestle Kingdom in January. But I think the overall follow-up to the Callis turn with Takeshita and him sort of repeating himself in a couple of promos and back-to-back weeks and talking about a family that hasn't formed yet and Takeshita not really having a whole lot to say on his own, it's been a bit of a miss. And so hopefully they can get that back on track at Forbidden Door.
Jake, anything else that you want to bring up from the show?
I think we covered just about every segment, kind of going back through it again. So I don't think so. I guess the only match we didn't talk about in any detail was the Cassidy and Shibata against Zack Sabre and Daniel Garcia. And I think the match was fine for what it was. I guess it was a decent setup for the four-way match, but I just wish they would have spent more time building up to this because I just think it could have been bigger than it actually ended up being, you know. But it was fine for a TV match, but it just didn't give me the, you know, the real push towards the fatal four-way that they booked afterwards on Sunday. So hopefully they touch on this again on Saturday before we get to the pay-per-view.
Yep. All right. Very good. Jake, I appreciate it very much. Thanks for co-hosting with me tonight.
Of course, man. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Yep, you bet. Thanks, everybody. I'll be by Saturday night after Collision and go VIP to hear our Forbidden Door post show also. And, of course, we'll have the SmackDown post show between now and then, too. If you didn't hear it, check out our Collision post show on Saturday night right here on this feed. Thanks, everybody. If you want to be an on-site correspondent, Wade Keller podcast at pwtorch.com. And, yeah, we'll talk to you all next time.